At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
A 12-year-old startup buys the centuries-old New York Stock Exchange. Why you should never, ever yell at a hotel desk clerk. And all you architects out there, you're a leading economic indicator. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdal. And this is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, December 20th. It's good to have you with us. The House votes tonight on Speaker John Boehner's Plan B that he says would prevent us from falling off the fiscal cliff. No matter what, though, looks like it's not going far. Senator Harry Reid says he won't bring the measure to the Senate, and the president said he'd veto it anyway. So now, a story about the iconic New York Stock Exchange. But we're not reporting it from Wall Street. That's because the NYSE is getting gobbled up by an upstart rival in Georgia, the Intercontinental Exchange. ICE is paying over $8 billion for the exchange's parent company. Jim Burris reports from Atlanta.
You'd think a company buying the NYSE would have a towering building downtown. Not exactly.
You have reached your destination.
GPS and two stops to ask for directions lead me to a nondescript suburban office complex. The building sign just says ICE. A tourist attraction? It's not.
Before you say anything, I have to ask you to leave the property.
And in a matter of seconds, a security guard escorts me out. It's okay, they won't be getting many visitors because the famous trading floor isn't coming to Atlanta.
There will still be a New York Stock Exchange and it'll be headquartered right where it is.
Jeff Rosenzweig teaches finance at Emory University. He says in today's world of online instant trades, physical location hardly matters. And ICE specializes in those types of trades, things like energy and commodities.
It will be, as far as I can see, kind of a dual headquarter thing.
ICE and NASDAQ paired last year in a bid to buy the NYSE, but regulators shot it down over antitrust concerns. This time, without NASDAQ in the picture, it should be smoother sailing.
In a word or two, bittersweet.
Seaport Securities Corporation President Ted Weisberg says today's news is bitter because...
At one point, there were 5,000 people that worked on the trading floor, and now... I don't know how many are down there, but my guess is it's 600 or 700, and that might be an exaggeration.
And why is it sweet? Because the deal would pay a 33% premium on the price of shares of the NYSE's parent company. In Atlanta, I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
There's a new survey out there that made me feel so much better about my Christmas procrastinating. It says more than half of Christmas consumers still plan to shop between now and Christmas. Good news is, with Christmas on a Tuesday this year, shoppers have the weekend plus an extra day to work through that gift list. And since Thanksgiving was early this year as well, it comes at the end of an already long holiday shopping season. As Sally Herships reports, smart retailers are cooking up new gimmicks to get you into their stores right up to the very last minute.
What do the extra shopping days before Christmas mean to retailers? Well, let's start with the basic.
Just the prosaic fact that if you have more days, more people will find their way into the store and buy things.
Paul Swinand is an equity analyst with Morningstar. He says when Christmas falls on a weekend, like it did last year, retailers can lose some of their heaviest shopping days. And a quirk in the way retailers keep their books means this year's Christmas quarter has an extra week, which Swinand says has CFOs licking their lips. But more time to shop also means the possibility of holiday fatigue. So smart retailers, says Swanand, are keeping their products fresh.
The kings of that is Nordstrom. They turn their goods so fast. I was just doing some store checks today, and some stuff that I saw last week was gone already.
Swanand says moving merchandise quickly tells customers, buy now. But letting goods sit on the shelf says expect sales, which is typically what retailers do before the holidays. However, finding other ways to get consumers into stores is much better for your bottom line. That's according to Wharton marketing professor Barbara Kahn. She says, take Macy's. Most of its stores will be open for, get ready for this, 48 hours straight this weekend.
I talked to some of my undergraduate students here, you know, and the idea of going shopping late at night, that's exciting. You know, there is something, it's something a little out of the ordinary, and so it does feel like it's special.
Especially for younger shoppers who appreciate a get out of your parents' house strategy. Toys R Us is staying open for 88 consecutive hours, and Sears says it's wooing people by offering in-store pickup for last-minute online purchases, which could be a good strategy this holiday season.
Ironically, even though there's 3 days of shopping, so there's Saturday, Sunday, and Monday before the Christmas day, I think you'll still see people pushing it to the very last minute just because they'll think they have so much time they don't have to rush out and shop, and next thing you'll know, it'll be Monday.
And if you wait till Monday, you'll probably end up buying a bunch of gift certificates, and everybody will know you procrastinated. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
A light trading day on Wall Street. Details when we do the numbers. If your upcoming holiday plans involve travel, and that travel involves staying at a hotel, you want to check out a new book called Heads in Beds. It's an insider's account of the hospitality industry that sort of pulls back the curtain on the hotel business. Author Jacob Tomsky is here with us. Mr. Tomsky, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, the subtitle of your book is A Reckless Memoir of Hotels, Hustles, and So-Called Hospitality. Why so-called?
It's service is sort of about the illusion of perfection and hospitality. You know, we are serving you, but, you know, we're people, and there's definitely a behind the scenes element that I wanted to express in the book. So, you know, sometimes we're smiling and bowing really low, but we're also having our own conversations behind your back.
Now, one thing you really emphasize to your readers is that the front desk agent at the hotel, they can make your life wonderful or they can make it miserable. You even suggest tipping them, and generously.
Sure. Interestingly, I mean, when you think about everyone involved in the hotel business, you know, the bellmen are tipped, doormen are tipped, concierge are tipped, maids are tipped, room service is tipped. The front desk is actually the only position that is non-tipped. Hence, a little bit of a gratuity is going to go a lot farther at that desk.
Well, tell me about that, because I'm curious. What can they do for me, that front desk agent, that I didn't know they could do for me?
Well, we could start with everyone's favorite word, which is usually upgrade. There's late checkouts. If you've ever had a late meeting and you want to just relax in the room and shower before your flight, I can offer you that. I can send up amenities. I can offer you free, you know, a free room service meal. There's 1,000 things that a front desk agent can do beyond just being your friend when you're traveling. You know, sometimes you really do need someone, you know, on your side.
So when do you tip and how much?
I would say right at the beginning, and it's not anything you should be ashamed of. It's a very kind thing to do. Again, I'm dealing with like possibly 500 guests in one day. So a $10 bill or a $20 bill right at the Ooh. Beginning slid across the desk that says, you know what, this is for you. Whatever you can do for me, I'd appreciate it. That's going to make me look up from my terminal and say, you know, that's really nice. And then, you know, because I'm not tipped, I'm going to do what I can for you and immediately try to earn that money because it's not normal for me to have it.
Now, you wrote something that I think websites like Expedia and Hotels.com are really going to hate you for, because you tell people, listen, if you book on the internet, your chances of getting a really good room go down. Really?
That's correct. I mean, from a business standpoint, those reservations come in bulk, let's say 50 in one day. They've all got the lowest rate possible. And those guests who booked on the internet usually chose based on price and price alone. Therefore, as a hotelier, you're looking at all your natural reservations, which have a higher rate. And they're people who booked with the property will probably stay here again. So it behooves the hotel to take care of those guests as they're a little bit higher priority. And then the Expedia guests or the Travelocity guests or any internet guests are going to sort of fall in line after that and with whatever's left.
You give a hint in the book of some of the sort of vengeful behavior of front desk agents or, you know, valets for people who treat them rudely. Give our listeners just a little hint of that.
Sure. I mean, we can go with the key bomb, which I think is something I invented. Basically, that's where when you check in, if for some reason, you know, you say something rude or homophobic or something I don't like or just yell at the doorman or yell at me, I'm going to give you two initial keys. And what happens is when you go up to your room, both your keys will work. You're going to put in one. You're going to get in your room. Either one will work. But then at one point in your stay, you're going to put in the second key. And at that point, it's going to eliminate the first key. It's going to reprogram the lock. So then fast forward another couple hours, you put the first key back in and you got a red light. This could be a day and a half later. So there you are, late for your meeting. You can't get in your door. And it was really something that I set up about 2 days ago or a day ago. And you're just now feeling it. And there's no way you'll trace that back to me.
What don't people know about the people who run hotels?
You know, that it's more of a money-based organization than people think. They think it's just they're all of a sudden there to be served. But it is a business. And, you know, that's the origin of the title, Heads in Beds. That's the bottom line of the hotel business, getting heads in beds. That's really all that's important, is clocking these room nights. And they're going to do what they can do to get you into the room, to get you to stay longer, to get you to order room service. You know, sometimes they won't put chairs in the lobby because the lobby is the only place in the hotel where you cannot spend money. They want you to go into the lounge. You can spend money there. Go upstairs. You're in the minibar. Bottom line, everyone's got to make money here.
Jacob Tomsky is the author of Heads in Beds, a reckless memoir of hotels, hustles, and so-called hospitality. Mr. Tomsky, it's been a pleasure.
Absolute pleasure for me as well.
And if you want to know how much Jacob thinks you should tip folks like valets and maids, check out marketplace.org. I've been a cheapskate all these years. This next story is about debt, old debts. In Philadelphia, city officials are going after money they say convicts owe them for skipping court dates and other offenses. Trouble is, the city never collected the debts at the time, and some of that debt now goes back decades. Amanda Aronchik reports.
Back in the early 1990s, when Rufus Taylor was growing up in North Philadelphia, he was a studious kid.
All I thought about was school, and that was it.
He remembers thinking to himself, maybe there's more to life than just studying.
I'm kind of very interested in what's going on over there on that corner. You know, and that's where I went. I got over there, and it was the thrill.
Unfortunately, Rufus's thrill was taking and driving other people's cars.
One, two, three.
That's Rufus counting his arrests. This might take a while.
Four, five, six, seven.
By the time he turned 18, he was in real trouble.
This is 21 separate arrests. This is all from my juvenile years.
Rufus was then arrested for helping some friends with an armed robbery. He spent the next 14 years in and out of prison, and by 2008, he was done with the courts. That is, until last year, when he couldn't collect welfare because of an outstanding financial debt.
I did my time. I did everything y'all requested. You don't let me know none of this until after I'm off parole.
Rufus apparently skipped out on bail four times back in 1994, and for that he owed a lot of money.
$41,897.70.
Almost $42,000. And it's not just Rufus Taylor facing a paralyzing debt. He's one of an estimated 300,000 people who owe the courts. That's one of every five people in Philadelphia.
Thank you very, very much.
And that's the city's mayor. Turns out that this is a retroactive fix, because for 40 years, the agency responsible for collecting this court money for bail and restitution, fees and fines, didn't. They didn't track the money, and they didn't collect the money. So in 2010, the city launched Stand Up, Pay Up.
When people owe, they need to pay. We want our money.
And not just a little bit of money, but $1.5 billion on debts dating back to when Richard Nixon was still president. Judge Pamela Denby, who oversees the courts, says since the recession hit, this is really necessary money.
This isn't like the court's playground fund. It goes right to the city. So this is taxpayer money.
and she thinks Rufus Taylor should be responsible for at least some of his share.
So here we have a guy, 1, 2, 3, 4 cases with 3 different names.
Rufus Taylor, Ricky Johnson, Ricky Smith.
This is clearly a guy who was well on his way to being a lifelong criminal, ducking the system at every possible opportunity.
Still, Judge Denby knows that Rufus and many of the other ex-offenders don't have the means to stand up pay up.
We're not asking them to come up with all the money at once. We really will live with any faintly reasonable payment plan.
So a few months ago, Rufus Taylor found a legal aid lawyer to dispute his debt, and he won. Sort of. The court vacated most of the $42,000, bringing it down to about $4,000 that he can pay off on a monthly plan. But he doesn't buy that this is about justice or reform.
It's nothing other than money. It's not about fair trial. It's not about fair judgments. It's money. I don't look at it in no other thing. It's not they're going to just say, well, I really want to rehabilitate you. That's bullshit. It's money.
The money Rufus Taylor owes is from 1994. His debt is now old enough to drive. For him and his lawyer, this is still unfair. And so earlier this month, they filed a second appeal to Judge Denby. Rufus doesn't have a steady job yet, and his monthly payments are a problem. But the last time I saw him, he had gotten some pickup work, fixing cars.
I like to restore them now. What I used to do to take them and demolish them, now I want to put it back together.
In Philadelphia, I'm Amanda Aronchik for Marketplace.
Coming up, the newest vodka on the block, Love Shack by Shaquille O'Neal.
There's a shift with all kinds of celebrity involvement in brands where they want to be behind the brand more than out front.
But first, let's do the numbers. Light trading today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average picked up 0.4% or 59 points to finish at 13,311. The NASDAQ added 0.2% or 6 points to end at 3050. The S&P 500 was up 0.5%, that's 7 points, to close at 1443. It was a good day on the New York Stock Exchange, but a better day for the New York Stock Exchange. As we reported, NYSE Euronext made a deal to sell the exchange for more than $8 billion to Intercontinental Exchange. The deal sent shares in NYSE Euronext up 34%. Intercontinental traded more than 1% higher. On the entertainment front, Amazon fired another salvo in the content wars. The online giant said it will produce pilots for 6 comedy series and let Amazon customers watch it for free. Its shares clicked up 1.3%. Netflix, which aims to be the content king, dipped 0.5%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The Commerce Department tells us how much money Americans made last month and what they spent it on. If you're torn between buying your favorite brand or picking up a few shares of its stock, luxury icon Christian Dior reports earnings. And oh yeah, the Mayan calendar ends. But if you're planning to tell off your boss or confess your undying love to a coworker, from all of us, please don't. I'm Gina Delvac.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Ristall. If you need another yardstick for the recovering construction business, how about this one? Work for Architects. It's back, at least according to an index of architecture billing. And November was the highest that's been since before the recession. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Architects got slammed when the housing sector cratered, but the latest index shows they're now getting more work. And Tom Gallis already knows that. He's a partner of an architecture firm in the Washington area.
We just today heard that one of our very large projects in the Pentagon City and Crystal City area is moving forward aggressively. This is over 700 residential units with a Whole Foods store at the base.
For a while, firms got work mostly planning projects. Now they're getting built. The index finds the best part of the sector is residential, ahead of office buildings and schools and hospitals. Economist Kermit Baker is with the American Institute of Architects.
We're starting to see some stability in house prices, and I think that's pretty important. Not too much incentive to buy a home if you think it's going to decline in value.
As far as jobs, November saw 2,400 new architecture and engineering spots. And despite new technology pushing out workers in other sectors, it's tricky for robots to design buildings. Doug Noble teaches architecture at the University of Southern California.
For decades, I've heard the story about, you know, technology means we can be smaller and have fewer employees, and we only need four architects for the whole country, and that'll be good. But I don't see that in the real world.
Noble thinks the future of the industry includes lots of energy-efficient buildings. Yeah, the green fad has come and gone, he says, but this time seems different. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Shahid Nazir arrived in London from his native Pakistan a year ago. He could never have imagined where he'd be today. Nazir got a job selling fish for £1, about $1.60, in a market in East London. And he wrote a song about it. Now he's the latest internet sensation. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has the story of how this Pakistani immigrant went from fish stall to fairy tale.
Not the most auspicious launch pad for a show business career, but it was at this market in East London that fish vendor Shahid Nazir began his meteoric rise. His boss told him to shout his sales pitch. He decided to sing it instead.
Come on, ladies, £1 fish. Come on, ladies.
Everyone said, your song is so catchy. Your voice is very good. You should be a pop star.
Did it help you sell a lot of fish?
Yes, the people love this song, even though some customers said, if you don't sing the song, we will not buy the fish.
Very, very good and very, very cheap. Come on, ladies, come on, £1 fish.
One of those customers filmed Shahid on his smartphone and uploaded the video to YouTube. 4.5 million hits later, the fish vendor is wallowing in global celebrity.
I never thought about this. One day I will become famous.
Now he has a manager, a record deal, and a following.
You can follow me on my Twitter. My Twitter is @real1poundfish. So you can follow me.
How many followers do you have?
28,000 people now follow me on the Twitter. So the Twitter is going mad after this happened.
Come on, ladies, come on, ladies.
Eager to cash in, Warner Music signed up Shahid, remixed his vocals with a Bhangra backing track, and shot a video of him shimmying with scantily clad Bollywood dancers and brandishing a fish. Warner's Anton Partridge produced the single.
I would hope to be able to at least break the top 40, and then from there, that's where we start seeing where the record will go.
But he's singing a song about fish. What kind of future does Shahid really have in the music industry? He's surely going to be a one-hit wonder.
More than likely, unless he changes market stalls and finds something new to sing about.
And that's his record producer speaking. Music critic Mark Sutherland is even less encouraging.
The music business, sadly, is a precarious place. I think if I was him, I'd probably keep the day job on for a while yet.
Even that might be tricky. Britain's border agency is investigating Shahid's immigration status. His path to lasting stardom looks a little rocky. But sitting in his manager's office in a room above a halal butcher's shop next to the market, Shahid is bullish. He's already trying to expand and diversify his repertoire. He's writing a new song.
It's not about fish.
It's about beauty, about a dream girl. I'm watching your face. I'm watching you. You are so beautiful.
That's all well and good, but in a world that demands something different, can another song about beauty match the novelty of £1 fish? In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Come on, ladies, come on, ladies. £1 fish.
Believe me, you got to go to our website, marketplace.org, and watch the music video. The fish guy dances, and so do the fish.
Check it out.
Basketball great Shaquille O'Neal never had a hit like 1 Pound Fish, but he's no stranger to catchy music videos. Now, though, Shaq is getting into the premium vodka business. In a move the LA Times calls either a stroke of marketing genius or a sign of devastating hubris, the basketball legend is launching a sugar-free, coconut-flavored vodka called Love Shaq. Marketplace's Amy Scott has the story.
Celebrities have a long history of endorsing booze. Here's Orson Welles in 1980.
Parmesan will sell no wine before its time.
These days, the rich and famous are creating their own brands. Justin Timberlake's got a premium tequila. Then there's Mansynth, Marilyn Manson's brand of absinthe. And remember these guys? Last year, the formerly mop-haired boy band Hanson, yeah, they're old enough to drink, announced plans to sell their own India Pale Ale called Hop.
I remember the press release on it. We posted something about it, and that is literally the last I've heard of it.
Jeff Cialetti is editor of Beverage World magazine. For that matter, when was the last time you mixed up a Trumptini with Trump vodka? But some of these brands succeed. Dan Aykroyd's Crystal Head vodka, the one in the skull-shaped bottles, has done well. So has Ciroc vodka. It's backed by Sean Diddy Combs. Jeffrey Kleinman with trade magazine BevNet says Diddy is more than just a pretty face.
There's a shift with all kinds of celebrity involvement in brands where they want to be behind the brand more than out front.
Devotion Vodka isn't saying much about Shaq's role in Love Shaq, baby. But the company itself admits it's a tough market. A Devotion rep brought this to my attention. 400 vodka brands are introduced every year, and only a few survive. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Some of you have already tweeted us your best Shaq-themed cocktail ideas. Here's one, Shaquilla Sunrise. And along the same lines, Banana Shaqri. And my favorite, the free throw. You miss the glass entirely when you go to pour it. Tweet us at Marketplace APM.
If you see a faded sign at the side of the road that says 15 miles to the
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And finally, a new study out today in the British Medical Journal confirms what parents already know. Don't let your babies grow up to be rock and roll stars. The study shows that, yes, rock and rollers are more likely to die a premature death than the general population. The study looked at rock and roll stars spanning 50 years and found over 9% of them died prematurely. And solo artists were twice as likely to die early as opposed to band members. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow picked up 0.4% or 59 points. The NASDAQ added 0.2% or 6 points. And the S&P 500 took home 0.5%. That's 7 points. John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Sylvester Monroe, Dave Shaw, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The acting managing editor is Ethan Lindsay. I'm Sarah Gardner. Join us again tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.